More paranormal stuff to talk about with Joshua Warren, and we'll take your calls as well here on Coast to Coast AM. George Norrie back with you with Joshua Warren. He is live in Puerto Rico. How often do you get to Puerto Rico these days, Josh?
Oh, well, you know, about half the year, almost half the year, I am here at the Bermuda Triangle Research Base. And, you know, this past year in particular, I mean, I have been all over North America, Canada, Mexico, California to Washington, D.C. I mean, you just name it. I bounce all over the place. And I love it because I'm able to get so many different perspectives on what's happening with the paranormal. And I love it when people send me reports and I'm able to travel and then go and look into these sites and these places and measure things for myself. And by the way, your extremely talented webmaster, Lex, has invited me once again to participate in a Coast to Coast AM chat.
Oh, great. You'll have
fun. April 26th. Yeah, and so I'm hoping that people may be able to contact me through the chat as well and give me new pictures to analyze, because we've got the best team out there and we're looking at every bit of data, technologically speaking, so that we can go to these places and find out what messages these beings from other perspectives, other realms, other dimensions are trying to tell us right now.
Get up to coasttocoastam.com and take a look at the highlight reel. Take a look at the picture of what Joshua P. Warren believes could be the ghost of George Washington. Now, when you just look at this picture and you can see this subject over there in the corner, a shadowy figure, what made you think that might have been Washington as opposed to something else?
Well, you know, for one thing, that was an area, this tavern, that George Washington used to frequent. And over the years, numerous people have said that they saw his ghost around that spot. The photographer actually said that she was talking about George Washington and had that sort of sense that his presence was around that night. And when you look at this picture of George Washington, now granted, or what may be his ghost, it might be impossible for us to discern between him and all the other people who might have passed through that tavern over the years.
Right.
But if you look at the enhancement there at my website, then you will see, when you compare it to the profile, the very famous profile of George Washington, it looks a heck of a lot like him. And furthermore, I should point out that some people, they look at this photograph of what could be this ghost and they say, well, it looks like he's wearing glasses. Well, it turns out George Washington actually did wear spectacles from time to time. But in this particular case, it's an optical illusion, because when you compare the phantom in the image that has sort of a translucent appearance to the control images, you'll see that he's standing right in front of a light fixture. And that light fixture has some kind of a little point on it that just so happens to sort of show up because that he has a fuzzy translucent form around where the eyes are. So in this case, we're not actually looking at a figure wearing spectacles, but he certainly could have been. But this, of course, brings us to the challenge in general when we start looking at what could be the phantoms of historic figures, such as what I was dealing with regarding the Lincoln photo. The White House is a very active place, it's a very haunted place. And so people would say to me, well, what makes you think that this photograph of Lincoln, or this photograph that I'm calling Lincoln, was Lincoln? Well, it's because the apparition just so happened to be standing right below the Lincoln bedroom, which was where Abraham Lincoln actually held his office. I mean, that was his office space during the Civil War.
At that time, yeah.
And this is the area where people have said that they've seen him. In fact, you know, I was reading up on just some of the reports about people who had seen Abraham Lincoln's ghost. One of the most interesting comes from Maureen Reagan. This is Ronald Reagan's daughter. She said publicly, quote, "I'm not kidding. We've really seen it. When I told my parents what I saw, they looked at me a little weirdly," end quote. But she said the spirit would appear to her sometimes in the early morning hours. Sometimes it had a bit of an aura around it. The very first person that we know of who publicly admitted to seeing the ghost of Lincoln was the wife of Calvin Coolidge. This was in the 1920s. First Lady Grace Coolidge said that she saw Lincoln standing at a window there and looking out over the Potomac. Teddy Roosevelt said that he saw the ghost of Abraham Lincoln. One of the most famous sightings was in 1942 when Queen Wilhelmina from the Netherlands heard footsteps outside of the bedroom, answered a knock on the door, and when she opened it, she saw Lincoln standing there in a frock and top hat, and she fainted. And so what we do is we have to compare what we're looking at here with the eyewitness reports. And it's obviously a lot easier to say we might be looking at Lincoln because he was a very distinctive-looking figure. And Washington was not as distinctive compared to his peers during his lifetime as Lincoln was compared to his peers during his lifetime. So it's easier to look at some of these and say, all right, this might be or probably is this historic figure. And so I feel much more confident that the photo we have of we call the Lincoln photo is Lincoln than I can be of the Washington photo. But if you compare that with the context, the sightings, the historic setting, it looks very much to me like this is the best chance we've ever had at examining a real photograph of Washington's spirit.
That's really exciting. I'm convinced, and I had a discussion with a person in St. Louis this week where I am, Josh, whose husband died. And she wanted to know about reincarnation, and I am convinced that the soul splits at death, and half of it goes and gets reincarnated as the entity, but the other half still stays behind to do whatever it does in its ghostly realm, and that's why we see them around so much. What do you think of that theory?
I think you're absolutely right, because I did an experiment several years ago. And this is something we've talked about on the program before that I think is mind-boggling, and a lot of people still have never heard of it, though, in which we made a Kirlian photograph. Now, Kirlian photography is a type of photography that actually shows the electrical field around the human body.
The aura.
And we took pretty much. And we took a photograph of a good friend and associate named Joe Southerns with his finger on a Kirlian plate, just as he was being knocked out by an energy practitioner, Grandmaster Tom Cameron in Chicago. And when I developed the photo, what we see are two distinct images. We see the image of Joe's physical finger, but we also see the image of what looks like a second finger that is knocked ajar from the original. So in other words, we are looking at, I believe, the physical corona around the physical form, as well as the corona around the energy body. So you have this distinct energy body, which is sort of overlaid with the physical body. And while the two are together, they sort of mimic each other. They look very much the same. On the other hand, once that physical form is separated from the energy form, well, then the energy form can change, and that's why sometimes the very oldest spirits, I think, out there, they appear as a misty form, or in some cases, they might just congeal and condense into a nice, solid ball of light, which is where some of these more authentic orb-type anomalies come into play. And so certainly there is some component of your body and your energy that I believe is certainly suited to exist here on the physical realm, whereas there's another part of you, which also is connected to your consciousness, which can travel and which can visit other realms. And we probably do this all the time when we sleep. Your mind is able to access other astral planes or etheric planes. There are many different names for this, but you can actually leave your body to a certain extent and then come back at night while you sleep. And so we're looking at a more complex form of this when people die.
All right, let's go to the phones now for you, Josh. We go to Tammy in Spokane, Washington to get this segment going. Hi, Tammy.
Hey, George, how are you?
Good. Good to hear from you.
Good. Thank you. I don't know if this has anything to do with George Washington, but my last name is spelled N-I-C-K-E-L-S, and Washington is on the nickel. And I experience a lot of phenomena, but not an aberration of George Washington yet, but an interesting phenomena with Lincoln.
And that profile of Washington on the nickel, Josh, yes, looks a little bit like the ghostly profile in that picture.
Oh, well, that's very interesting.
Yeah, there is this classic profile that's associated with George Washington, and that's one of the things that we sort of have within our subliminal perception. You don't have to think about it. You know, you could see just the silhouette of George Washington and know instantly, oh, yeah, that's the father of the country. And you get that same feeling when you look at this image from this ghost photo that you can see at coasttocoastam.com.
We have Christian now in San Pedro, California. Welcome to the show. You're on with Joshua Warren. Christian, go ahead.
Oh, George, how you doing? It's me, Chris. I've called into your show numerous times.
Sure.
I've been a long-time listener for over a decade. Sure, you recognize my voice. Very distinct. I have a question, a comment, actually. And I've thought about this a lot, at least over the years since the financial crisis. And you know, George, you've had many guests, you know, financial experts, advisors, who've been talking about the corruption of Wall Street and what's happened to the country. I have often felt that if the founding fathers, like George Washington and Thomas Jefferson and John Adams and Benjamin Franklin, could come back from the dead, come back to the present day, and they were to, let's say, be briefed in the White House Situation Room or, let's say, the Pentagon, and pretty much be brought up to Vince to just, look, this is how far the country has gone over the last 200-some-odd years, and be pretty much just be told everything, you know, that I think they would come to realize that the banking system, it's like what Carol Quigley predicted in his book Tragedy and Hope, that essentially the global bankers in multinational corporations are running the country. They are the government.
They are.
And essentially the president of the United States, and this is true, the president of the United States, whether it's Barack Obama or whoever it's going to be who succeeds him, the president, I feel, no longer has the power. He doesn't really run the country. It's almost like the presidency now is more of like a ceremonial figurehead. The real government is a shadow government running the country from behind closed doors. Like Cheney, for example, and you've had several guests on your show who've said that point blank that Cheney was the one who was really running the country. The presidency, the power has been taken away from the people, and it's been put essentially into the hands of an oligarchy. And it's, you know, just curious, how do you feel about, you know, kind of my comments? And I'll listen to on the air.
Well, I tell you what, let's reserve those for open lines because we're dealing with Joshua Warren and the ghostly realm. But we'll talk about that next hour a little bit. Josh, but if they did come back, these presidents, I think they'd go nuts, wouldn't they?
Yeah, well, you know, I thought a lot about that. And, you know, it seems to me that it would be sort of a double-edged sword for them. For one thing, if these presidents are in fact back and or never left, really, and they've been observing us all this time, I think on one hand, they're really impressed that we have made it at all. I mean, this was a big experiment that worked against all odds.
Would they intercede, though, Josh? Would they try to fix things, these ghostly presidents?
I think what they would do is try to remind us of what the original intention was. And I think that's what they're doing by coming back and appearing. I mean, when they come back and they appear, it forces us to reexamine who they were and to look at their lives and what they sacrificed and what they meant to do. I think they would be just absolutely disappointed, though, by this, what Eisenhower called in his farewell address, military-industrial complex, which is what Christian, I think, was partly alluding to, this idea that the bankers and the private industry and the corporations have sort of slithered their way into government to such an extent that it's very difficult to figure out who is accountable for what anymore. And I think it's also really disappointing that only the super rich have a chance of becoming president now, and that hasn't always been the case. And so ultimately, I think the presidents, the original founders, would caution us to try to do whatever we can, unless it's too late. And frankly, it might be too late. To remove these entanglements between the private, corporate, selfish interests and what the people are able to vote upon. But at the same time, I think they realize that we're pretty darn lucky that we have any kind of a cohesive country existing at all when people are so adamant about their own divisive politics. And that's another thing. In George Washington's farewell address, he was warning us against the forming political parties at all. The political parties serve no other purpose than to divide us. And so I would like to see a country in which we don't even have parties anymore. We vote for individuals who stand for their own specific, unique identities and beliefs.
He would probably be floating around copies of the Declaration of Independence. You would see them float around in the air, landing on tables, and sections would be circled, I would guess.
Well, yeah, and I think the Declaration of Independence is perhaps the most important document of all, because it at that time, when these fellows crafted the Declaration of Independence, they were absolutely desperate. I mean, if you look at a lot of the legislation that came afterward, even the Constitution, at that time, they at least had some confidence that they had achieved some major goals, and they'd overcome some of the biggest obstacles, and so they felt a little more at peace, and they were able to take a little more time to think about things perhaps more rationally than they should have. But when the Declaration was crafted, I mean, these guys, they had nothing statistically to rely upon other than their faith, and that's why I believe that the references to a creator or providence are so much more stressed in the Declaration than any of the other U.S. federal documents that exist.
In the movie The Christmas Carol, Scrooge's partner, Jacob Marley, shows up in chains. Do you think that some of these presidents are chained, basically hampered, that there's nothing they can do to help anything?
Ah, what a great analogy. Certainly, I believe that that is the perfect way of imagining the repercussions for one's actions. The idea that what you do in life is create an energy field about you that you are going to take with you when you transition from this form to the next form. And many people find that out too late. I think that all of the presidents carry a chain of some kind.
I think you're right. Josh, we're going to come back and take some final questions for you right here on Coast to Coast AM. Well, I've got a couple announcements here for you. First of all, I'm doing a benefit for the Red Cross with our great affiliate here in Los Angeles, KFIAM 640, and this is what I need you to do. Once again, as we've been doing this for years now, we're auctioning off dinner with me at Morton's in Burbank, and you can bid right now until May 1st to support the American Red Cross's initiative to Get Prepared California. So log on to KFIAM640.com, search for the Red Cross. Also, we've got a link for you at coasttocoastam.com. Right there in the middle of the homepage, you just click it, takes you straight there. The proceeds go to disaster preparedness and relief in California. And I think last year, a great guy by the name of Dean Hazen bid over $3,000 to go to dinner. And what a great guy. So go ahead and take care of that. We'll be talking about that as we get into May 1st, which is a couple weeks away. And also a major event, live event, June 18th at Lindenwood University in St. Louis. They are starting to sell tickets like hotcakes. So just go to this website. I'd love for you to come out. It's going to be a great program with guests like Stanton Friedman and rock historian R. Gary Patterson talking about the Club of 27, the people who die at the age of 27. Go to 971talk.com. That's it. Simple as that. 971, and you, those are just the numbers, 971talk.com. Our Skype line's open for you, too, at 97, George, 97313. George, 97313. Josh, what does it tell you if these presidential ghosts never showed up? What's that tell you?
Well, I would like to think that if they never showed up, then that means they are completely at peace, meaning that they felt like job well done. There is no sense of guilt, which, of course, is one of the big things that keeps people here instead of moving on. They feel a little guilty, a little unsure, and they want to make sure that they have a nice, balanced, positive field before they move on. And so most of the time in my life, when I have met a friend who has passed on, and that friend was a person who really had reached some sense of, you know, peace and satisfaction, I never get any kind of ghostly contact or with that person. I never get an EVP. I never see a ghost photo. Nobody ever talks about seeing the person. It's when folks have some kind of an unresolved life that they tend to stick around. And it's obviously people like the presidents who would feel that sense of maybe some kind of unresolved emotion, because that the United States is a work in progress, and they are the individuals who embody that work in progress. And so probably it's the ones that we see appearing as ghosts that have more of that sort of turmoil within. And so that's why it makes sense that these also are some of the men that had the most dire situations on their hands.
Josh, in your career of investigating the paranormal, have you ever seen anything like a demon or some kind of entity like that hanging around?
I don't know that I can say that I've actually seen a demon. However, I have been in the presence of things that seemed very dark and scary. You know, I have been to locations before where everybody is sick and nothing works properly. Mm-hmm. Pets are dropping dead. You know, there's a very sort of nasty aroma that you sometimes can smell in the air. So there are places that are sort of permeated by this kind of dark energy that we define as demonic, but I've never actually seen a demonic entity with my own two eyes.
How often is a Ouija board associated with some of these entities that seem to hang around?
Well, you know, the Ouija board issue has always been a very mixed issue for me, and that's because because
you probably like it.
Yeah, well, you know, when I've used the Ouija board over the years, I have I've never actually seen anything dark and negative appear. But I get stories like you all the time from people who say I was using a Ouija board and something bad happened. But now, I did an experiment one time at my laboratory in Asheville, which really stood out or stands out in my mind. There were a couple of ladies who were very, very apt at using Ouija boards effectively. And I had them sit in the laboratory in the Mystery Museum. And I had them put their hands around the Ouija board, and I asked them questions. And they seemed to be having great success. The planchette was sliding around all over the place, and they were giving me very coherent and cogent answers. And then I said, all right, now let's change things a little bit. And I blindfolded both of them, and I had them do the same thing, and now all of a sudden it starts speaking gibberish. Huh. So I believe that what you're really doing when you use a Ouija board is you're tapping in to yourself. You're really trying to, you know, access your own psychic potential, And now, George, of course, I mentioned this earlier. On August 27th, you're coming to Asheville to do a big event with me and Dr. Bill Forsten and Micah Hanks. How would you feel about doing some kind of a Ouija board experiment during the show? Would that be pushing the boundaries too far?
You and Micah can do it, and I'll oversee it, but I'm not going to sit down and do it.
Okay, well, if Micah or I, for some reason I'm thinking Dr. Bill wouldn't do it, but Micah might.
And maybe we'll do it right at the end of the show and give the people in the audience the option of leaving if they want.
Yeah, well, that's, you know what, that's a great idea. You know, tickets for that go on sale May 3rd, and I know we're going to have a big, big crowd there, and I look forward to meeting everybody.
It's an intimate theater, too. How many does it seat?
Well, it's the Diana Wortham Theater, and I'm not sure about the exact number of people. For some reason, I want to say it's between 500 and 1,000. I have no doubt it's going to sell out. And of course, we're going to meet people in person afterward.
Of course.
I'll be signing copies. I've got a new novel out. You know, a lot of people are familiar with my nonfiction books, but I have a novel about a bunch of, about a couple of guys who are on a conspiracy-fueled quest to kill a bunch of bad guys to save an alien. It's called The Gringo Maniac Murder Spree. And I've already got some interest from Hollywood in the story. So I'm going to be signing copies of my novel there and meeting people. And so hopefully, as soon as tickets go on sale May 3rd, we'll have a nice big crowd there that buys them, and we can have a lot of fun that day.
You got it. Let's now go back to the phones. Let's go to Jeff in Festus, Missouri. Welcome to the program. Hi, Jeff.
Hello, George.
Good to have you with us, Jeff.
Yeah, one day we're going to have to throw knuckleballs at each other, George.
You got it. That'll be fun.
Joshua, a number of shows back, you were talking about a mirror box with the mirrors on the focused on the inside to open some kind of portal. I looked on the internet and tried to find it, something else about it, but it all comes back to you. Is there anything that you've done else that you've done with that?
Yeah, you know, thanks for that message. I'm always happy to update everybody on this, Jeff. It's called the Devil's Toy Box, and I'll tell you the story behind the Devil's Toy Box. Of course, for centuries, people have been using mirrors and reflective surfaces in order to communicate with the other side. And I noticed very early on in my ghost investigation career that frequently I would go to a haunted house and the owner of the house would say, "That's the haunted room." And I would walk into the room, and sure enough, somewhere in that room, I would find two mirrors facing each other. And this, of course, creates what looks like an infinite image, a mirror within a mirror within a mirror, and so it looks like a tunnel. And it got to the point to where I would walk into people's homes, and I'd say, "Don't tell me where the haunted room is," and I'd walk around, and I would see that, and I would say, "Bet it's here," and they'd say, "Yeah, how'd you know?" So I'd always heard that you could take mirrors and face them in certain configurations to create some kind of an interdimensional portal. I'm not sure where the term devil's toy box exactly originated from, but I started making these. And what you do is take a little square mirror. The dimensions really don't matter. Could be a few inches. The largest I've ever seen would be maybe a foot, but it has to be equal on every side. And you take these six mirrors and you glue them together to form a cube, with each of the reflective sides on the inside. Now, once you do that, you start to see strange phenomena happen around the box. But my focus was taking microphones and hooking the microphones directly to the boxes, like some of these microphones that have a little suction cup. And so, I would hook the microphone to the box and then make recordings. And I got one recording one time that was just blood-curdling. We played it on Coast to Coast AM. It sounded like wailing and growling. And so I got really excited, and I thought, well, when you put this together, it creates some kind of an antenna and it is allowing you to sort of open up a hole in the dimensions so that you can listen or gather some kind of spooky information wherever the box is. But what I found, however, is that the results are unfortunately inconsistent. If the box itself was capable of opening a portal wherever it is, then you should get these results all the time. But what I found was that usually you'd get better results if you took it to a place where there was already some paranormal activity. So what I can tell you is that at this point, I believe that the Devil's Toy Box does function as an antenna, as a very effective
what
antenna.
A name, though, the Devil's Toy Box. Yikes.
Yeah, but I don't think that it necessarily is able to open up a portal wherever it is. And one of the reasons that I feel comfortable that that term is appropriate, George, is it seems like that most of the time when you get some kind of results, it sounds creepy. I mean, it doesn't sound nice. In fact, if you go to YouTube and just do a search for Devil's Toy Box, you'll find quite a few videos from people who have built them and have experimented with them and gotten results. And so, you know, a lot of the things I talk about are things that I do as an experimenter, and I share them on the airwaves for other people who are experimenters. So I don't recommend that everybody go out and build one of these things. But if you're one of these people like I am, if you like messing around with, you know, wishing machines and Tesla coils and various forms of exotic technology, I'd love for you to build one and let me know what your results are.
Well, with Joshua P. Warren, final segment, so we're going to take your final call, so jump on board before the clock gets us. Let's go to Tana in Washington, Wisconsin. Welcome to the show, Tana.
Hi, how are you?
I'm great. Love your name.
Thank you very much. My parents are cool. So anyway, I wanted to discuss maybe this theory. A study was done a few years ago with University of Illinois where they sipped blood samples. They gave the people that the blood was drawn shock, and the blood reacted at the same moment that the shocks were given.
Like it was alive.
Yes. So my theory is that in hauntings, and especially like powerful, like presidents, all that, their DNA is left behind, like extreme bloodshed places, DNA everywhere. So I'm wondering if the DNA is actually doing the haunting because it has
much. Interesting thought. Josh, what do you think?
Well, you know, Todd, that is a fantastic sort of a subject and an angle on a really interesting area because, you know, I believe that you have two different types of ghostly activity. You have these things that we call entities, conscious, interactive, aware spirits. And then you have these things which we call imprints, which seem to be something that's impressed upon the environment. And I tend to think that if you take some of these, you know, let's say you go to Walmart and you have a package that you pick up and it's got an RFID chip on it. Well, these chips are passive. They're just sitting there doing nothing. But when you walk out of the store, they get zapped with an electromagnetic beam, and that wakes them up and activates them, and then they start sending signals back, and the buzzer goes off. And so it may be that the environment itself is sort of like layer upon layer of little RFID chips that are just sitting there, and they are somehow storing the information from past events. Now, when certain people walk into these environments and they shine their consciousness upon them, well, guess what? They wake up, they activate, and they start sending and projecting information. And it would make perfect sense that DNA would be a perfect conduit for this kind of passive information to be stored. I mean, look how much information in general is stored in that double helix formation of a strand of DNA. And so absolutely, when you have got a place that has been doused in blood, then it may very well be that that blood is able to hold even more of that information. Even when you wash it away, even when 50 years have gone by or 100 years have gone by, there's still some of it. somewhere there in the environment, and that it might make those places even more powerful, make them wake up and reactivate and start sending back these images and impressions from the past even more intensely. So you're absolutely right, Tada.
Josh, did you ever doubt the possibility that the afterlife existed?
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
you did.
I mean,
I've had that too.
Yeah, you know, when I grew up not knowing, I mean, I always had a very agnostic point of view, and I was open-minded, and I went to a lot of different kinds of churches and listened to different spiritual beliefs, but I need to experience things for myself, just like most people, and things didn't take a dramatic turn for me until I spent that night at Myrtle's Plantation in St. Lawrenceville, or St. Francisville, Louisiana.
That did it.
And
huh?
That's when there was an entity in the room there, something around on the walls, and there's video footage of that. I captured it on video. It's in my Gallery of the Strange on my website. And that, to me, was clear evidence of an aware, interactive, conscious being that made me once and for all say, okay, there is an afterlife.
Let's go to Mike in Ohio. Mike, it's your turn. Go ahead, sir.
Hey, good morning, George. Good morning, Joshua.
Hey, Mike.
Hey, one of my ancestors actually rented the room to John Wilkes Booth before he shot the president.
Oh, wow.
Huh. He was, you know, pulled before Congress, the investigation. He was cleared. He just rented the room at the
Yeah, he had no idea what he was going to do. Honestly.
Yeah, you know, so that's crazy. But my grandfather told me years ago.
Wow.
And what I want to ask you, Joshua, have you ever done any paranormal investigations into the assassins of the presidents, like Wilkes Booth or
Oswald, if it was Oswald, even though I don't think it was.
And if you ever get a hold of Oswald, I know George wants to ask him a few questions.
Oh, yeah. Many, many, many. 30 seconds left. Josh, go ahead.
Mike, fantastic question. Interesting timing because I'm really interested in that subject. In fact, just last year, I was in New Orleans researching a lot of Oswald's connections, and I have a friend right now who is trying to get access for us to investigate the actual spot where President Lincoln was assassinated by Booth in Ford's Theater. So I'm working on those things, and you're right. Those would be perfect areas to find
it sure
some
would.
Of this ghostly residue.
And I'm pretty sure, Josh, that the chair that Lincoln was in at the Ford Theater is at the Smithsonian. I think I saw it when I was a kid a long, long time ago. Up next, 2 hours of open lines right here on Coast to Coast AM.